Hello, this is Neil Ruda. Welcome to Unsung Missionary Heroes, interviews with heroes of the faith. This podcast is brought to you by the 9 international ministries of Assemblies of God World Missions. These ministries are Builders International, Compassion Link, Global Initiative, Global University, Jacob's Hope, Life Publishers, Network 21-1, Oral Learners Initiative, and Royal Rangers International. For more information, visit im-agwm.org. Now let's join our podcast. It's a delight to be here today with Dr. Joanne Buterin, longtime missionary and colleague and friend. And it's my privilege to interview her, and I believe that what you're going to hear from Joanne is going to be a blessing to you today. So, Joanne, thank you and welcome. I appreciate you taking time to do this.
Thank you, Neil. It's a real honor.
Let me begin by asking, Jo, how did you become a Christian?
Well, I grew up in a pastor's home, and so from the time I can remember, I was surrounded by Christianity and sermons and sitting, listening my dad preach.
Yeah.
And I would often be the one at the altar call that raised my hand, which is always a help to a minister to say, I see that hand, you know. But actually, when I was about 5, I loved Jesus so much, and in children's church, actually, not in my father's service, I accepted Jesus, and in a very real and dramatic way, I knew I was his daughter at that point.
How were you called to missions?
So because we didn't do the motel thing for missionaries in those days, it was my bedroom who got to be the guest room for whatever missionary we were having. And at times we would have missionaries actually stay for several weeks in our home. I think the highlight for me was when Lillian Trasher from the orphanage in Egypt came. I was just so fascinated by her. She was a missionary nurse who had started an orphanage in Egypt and had like 100 babies and children in that orphanage at that time. The wonderful thing is that orphanage is still is still going on today. I remember her taking me in her arms and saying, "Little girl, God has a plan for your life." And that was just so impactful to me. I don't know, I think coming out of that encounter, I started saying to my parents, when I grow up, I want to be a missionary nurse. And in fact, that is what I became. So I think that was the beginning of the seeds planted. But because of the missionaries coming and going in our home, my heart was always softened to missions. And there was a day praying around the altar when I was about 7 years old. And I saw myself in a large crowd of dark-skinned people, and I was the only white person there, so it was very obvious that it was Africa. And I told my parents that I wanted to be a missionary nurse to Africa, and that sort of stuck with me all my growing up years.
And then what began your career in missions?
I was in Springfield, Missouri at Central Bible College, and I felt like I'd been waiting all my life to be able to become a missionary. So I went into the Division of Foreign Missions that it was called at that time, and I said, I just want to be a nurse in Africa. Well, as it turned out, they had just started the Missionary Associate Program, and the person who was heading it, John Olin, had a cousin who was a nurse in Congo, Africa, and he said, I know just the place you need to go, because she had gone out with a coworker, but her coworker married a maps builder and moved away. And so Peggy was left on her own out there in Congo, Africa. And so I got support raised. My dad helped me, of course, with his pastor friends. And before I knew it, at the age of 22, I was arriving in Congo, Africa as a missionary associate.
Now, for those that know you, you need to tell the story of the polka dot dress.
Yes, well, that's a story that's gone far and wide. But I didn't have much of an orientation when I left the U.S., in fact, none at that time. And I didn't know better that I should be dressed in a certain way. So I put on what we were wearing in the 70s, which was a miniskirt. And it happened to be a blue and white polka dot miniskirt. And that's what I wore when I flew into the mission station I was going to be a part of. So my coworker had driven in from the jungle to this little town where there was an airstrip. And I got off the plane in this blue and white polka dot miniskirt, and she said, "Oh, dear Lord, what have you sent me?" And we laughed about it for this day because I just didn't know. And I soon learned to cover up because like showing legs in that part of Africa was not appropriate. But it just took me a little adjusting to fit into the culture of that day.
And you ended up working with her for many years.
We did. We became great friends and co-workers, and we actually worked together for almost 30 years.
Yeah.
She then met the man of her dreams, John Canutti, and she got married and moved away, but we just had some wonderful years of ministry together.
Yeah. What are some of the highlights?
Well, I believe getting the grassroots experience in Congo, we were out in the jungle, and we had a little hospital and clinic, and it was just wonderful to see people being ministered to physically, but we would also take some time to talk to them about Jesus, and we saw people starting to give their hearts to the Lord right there in the clinical area. Mm-hmm. So we hired a hospital pastor and began to see remarkable things, healings, salvations, people even being baptized in the Spirit. They're in the clinical setting.
Yeah.
So I think that was just a huge highlight for me, just seeing so many people come to faith. And then later when I joined what was then called Healthcare Ministries, mm-hmm. I was able to take that grassroots experience and go with medical teams really all over the world. I recall probably one of the most miraculous healings that I recall in my ministry was a woman came in with what we call a septic shoulder. Her whole shoulder was infected and on fire, and it was twice its size and red and hot, and she was in so much pain that the very slightest movement of her arm would cause her to cry out. So we began to pray for her and just cry over her and plead the blood over her, and in the middle of our prayer, she shouted out, and she said, "I'm healed, I'm healed." And well, I've never seen anything quite that dramatic. And she began to be able to lift her arm, which she hadn't been able to for weeks. It was, I think, the next night I was speaking in the evening service and had people come forward. And she was in the people that came forward, and she got my attention, and she pointed to her shoulder, and she just kept lifting it up and down, showing me that she had been completely healed. So, I mean, there were many healings, but to me, that one was the most miraculous and truly a highlight of my ministry career.
I'm going to put you on the spot here, but through the years, can you estimate the number of people that healthcare would have served?
Oh, it was thousands, really thousands. I don't have that number in hand because it's been quite a few years, but many times we would see over 1,200 people in a week, and a good third of them, if they hadn't been Christians, would pray to mm-hmm. receive Jesus. The cool thing was we always worked in the context of a local church, so that when people did say they wanted to receive Jesus and pray with us, then we would have follow-up with the local church. And I think that was a real key to seeing that these people didn't just pray a prayer, but they truly were discipled and brought into the church. And that just happened over and over again. We had a team almost every month for 18 years we were doing that. So I can't imagine the numbers of people that are with Jesus now or serving Jesus because of the medical teams that we did.
And I think of all of the people in the medical field, in the medical profession, that were exposed to missions in a way that they would not have ever been exposed.
Exactly, that's right. And so many of them became evangelists as they were witnessing. They saw how beautifully meeting physical needs and meeting spiritual needs went together. It was a beautiful thing that we did for many, many years.
So, Jill, were there low points?
Well, of course, I guess in ministry there always are. You know, eventually I was asked to become the director of international ministries, which gave me a seat on the executive committee. I was the only woman to have that role, and it was a real honor and privilege for me to be part of being the decision-making group for world missions, and I really loved it. But at one point in time, some of the ministries that I was responsible for kind of came under attack. I'm like a mother hen when it comes comes to the ministries I was responsible for, like, don't you dare touch any of my ministries or be critical in any way. Do you know, as I began to pray about that process, which was ended up taking about a year, what the Lord just spoke to me was, you know, this is going to be hard. It's going to be a difficult time. But if you can just listen, you will come out okay in the end. And that was the word the Lord gave me, was listen. Because my initial reaction was defensiveness and to fight, you know. But the word I got was listen. And so as this group of six guys began to meet with me, and we began to sort through, I began to really hear their concerns. And instead of shouting, no, 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 you know, I was actually hearing that. And so in the end, I think our respect for each other all grew. And we were able to tool out some solutions that were really helpful for mm-hmm. both sides. So it was a hard time. There were times when I just wanted to, I did cry a lot. And I was thinking, what am I doing this for? But on the other hand, I just had this sweet assurance that the Lord was walking with me, and that in the final end it was going to be okay if I listened, which I did.
Joe, you've written several books, including one recently called The Men and Me, and I think what you've just been talking about is reflected in that book. Can you tell us about the book?
Well, you know, I spent 17 years sitting around the table with these men of the executive committee. There were 12 of them and one of me. And we had to do some really hard things. But when I first joined the committee, because I was the minority and the only woman, I felt like I had to talk to every issue and I had to fight for everything. And I was almost militant, mm-hmm. I guess you could say. And so it became a me and them situation where seemed like I was always fighting. I remember thinking, oh, Lord, why did you set me up like this? You know, it's just so hard and so again, that word of kind of backing down from the militancy and just listening and taking in. And I asked the Lord to really give me a true love for my brothers around that table and to respect, you know, because they were sitting around the table just as equal as I was. Mm-hmm. They were put in there by their constituents and by the powers that be as I was. And so I really began to settle in from being a strong militant woman to trying to be more of a woman of strength and relying on God and keeping my mouth shut more than it was open. Mm-hmm. I really learned a lot about that sort of thing of being a minority, but being able to be an equal voice when necessary, but not using my voice when it wasn't necessary. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, you know, I should document this experience. Yeah. So I began writing a book called The Men and Me, Tips for Being the Only Female on the Team. And I tried to put some things that I'd learned along the way. I actually surveyed the men that were initially there when I first came on the committee. I thought they would really lambast me, but they didn't. I think they've forgotten how I really was. And I surveyed the men who are presently there as well. And for the most part, they gave me pretty positive reviews on that survey. Then I started documenting some tips for men when they're working with a majority male team and just a few females or the only female. And then some tips for women, how to sort of conduct yourself in a manner that shows you that you have an equal voice, but you're not domineering and talking too much. And I've learned over the years what men like around that table mm-hmm. and what they don't like. Yeah. And so I think when we can learn a few things about how to be the minority in a room, it's helpful. So I did document that, and so far the book has been doing pretty well. Yeah.
Now, you wrote another book, From the Roots Up. Your title is intriguing. Can you tell us about that book?
Yes, that was one of my early publications. It was actually back a few years. But because I have become so schooled in the idea of sustainable development and that we as Americans, because we have the capacity to give to people who are in need, sometimes we override their ability mm-hmm. to be able to do what they're good at or what they're capable of doing just by our enthusiasm and our good intentions about being able to provide what we think they need. So I document some of my experiences in Africa where we thought we were doing a good thing, and then turns out it actually made people dependent or angry, one or the other. And when I really began to look at the root of what was going on there, I realized that we just hadn't taken people into consideration. We hadn't even asked the question, if you could have a need met, what would your primary need be? Mm-hmm. And what are the things that you're already good at? What are your assets? And so I tried to put some good best practice principles of compassion and justice, and really talked a lot about sustainability and sustainable development in my book. I have to say, over the years, a number of our AG universities and schools have decided to use that book as one of their textbooks, especially in their relief and development tracks. So that's been very rewarding as well. I really need to revise that book, but I just haven't gotten around to that yet.
Well, Joe, if you could offer some tips to new missionaries, what would they be?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, I have been doing missions for over 50 years, so I guess I have authority to speak to that. But I think for me, I would say, remember your calling, remember who called you, and try to keep that fresh in your mind. You know, when the hard times come and we kind of want to give up, we have to remember that this isn't a job.
Yeah.
It's not just an occupation, it's a calling. And that calling just kind of has to stay clear and fresh in our minds at all times. I think that's just so important. It's what got me through some of those really tough hurdles, having to deal with some really hard issues. But I knew that I was called to that role of missionary. I knew that I was called to be a leader. And I just kind of tried to keep that in my view all the time. I think as Pentecostals, we have an advantage too, because we can depend on the Holy Spirit. We don't have to make every decision alone. We don't have to make every new direction on our own, because we have the Holy Spirit. And if we really seek the Holy Spirit's guidance in our decisions, in our everyday life, in our ministry, we can get that prompting and guiding and direction that we need. And I found that to be critically important in my ministry. I also have heard the term, an offense is only an offense if it's taken. And I really think there's so much to that little phrase, because we can choose not to take an offense. We can choose not to be offended, actually. I've learned over the years, because I've certainly had my share of critique and criticism, and I've learned to listen to that and say, okay, is there something in that critique that is good and that maybe needs to be adjusted? And then I've tried to learn to let the rest fall away without offense. Okay, that person said something that was really hurtful, but maybe in that there was something that I do need to look at. On the other hand, I choose not to be offended by that. And so that little line, an offense is only offense if it's taken, has been really helpful to me through the years. And lastly, and I probably every missionary would say the same, is learn flexibility. Mm-hmm. Leadership makes a decision that we don't like, and that certainly has happened to me, still does sometimes. I just say, you know what? That's the leader. I'm not. I'm just going to flex with that decision and see where we go. And I think if we can learn to flex our lives, not to where we compromise and not to where we let go of a principle that we feel is important. There were times when, even if I was the only voice in the executive room on a decision, if I felt strongly about it and prompted by the Holy Spirit, I would speak my opinion, whether I knew I was going to be outvoted or not. But when the room says, nope, this is the way we're going to go, then I have to be flexible. Mm-hmm. I have to be submissive and just say, this is the leadership, that's their decision, I'm under their authority, and I'm going to go with it. So I think those things are some of the things that have really carried me through these 50-plus years of missionary work.
If you could recommend a couple books, what comes to mind?
Well, of course, The Indigenous Principles of the Church by Melvin Hodges is an old, old book. Yeah. But you know what? If you
still
read
timely.
It is incredibly timely today. Yeah. The principles that we put forward in Compassion Link, for example, about sustainability and community development and helping people help themselves, that's all there in that book, if you really line up those things. It's helping people be able to move forward on their own with their skills, capacities, and assets, And really, that's what that book is all about. A more modern version of those same principles, I would say, would be When Helping Hurts by Brian Fickard and Steve Corbett. Both of these guys I know, I've met, I respect them highly. We've had them in to do conferences for us, but they pretty much put out similar principles. Mm-hmm. I think it's become a standard. Another one I just love is one by Bryant Myers called Walking with the Poor. And for those of us working with marginalized people, really any kind of people, I think, that book just gives some wonderful ideas of how to have healthy relationships with God, with others, with ourselves, and even with our surroundings. And that's become a hallmark and standard for the way I look at life, is when all those relationships that I just named are going right, we're going to be in good standing, in good health, and we're going to be able to move forward. But even when one of those relationships goes wrong, then we can fall into poverty, not just materially, but poverty of spirit, mm-hmm. poverty of relationship. So those kinds of principles from Bryant Myers' book, Walking with the Poor, will carries mm-hmm. over into my book. It carries over into When Helping Hurts as well. Yeah. They quote Brian Myers yeah. in Relationships Gone Wrong.
Well, Joanne, thank you for taking time today to do this. It's been a privilege and an honor to interview you. And I trust that people have learned something from your many years of experience on the field. God bless you.
Thank you, Neil. And thank you for capturing our histories. Because without this, I don't know that anybody will remember quite a few years down the road. So I think this is just really important, and I appreciate being part of your interviewees.
You're welcome. Well, that's our podcast for today on Unsung Missionary Heroes, Interviews with Heroes of the Faith. My name is Neil Ruda. This podcast has been brought to you by the 9 International Ministries of Assemblies of God World Missions. They are Builders International, Compassion Link, Global Initiative, Global University, Jacob's Hope, Life Publishers, Network 21-1, Oral Learners Initiative, and Royal Rangers International. You can check all of them out at im-agwm.org. Thanks again for joining us, and come back again and listen to our next podcast.